Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hi there and welcome to the Stock Club podcast, coming to you from the top floor of my Wall Street HQ here in Dublin, Ireland. I'm James and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor Emmett Savage and our head analyst Rory Caron. Before we start today's episode, please hit that subscribe button on whatever platform you're listening to us on to make sure you don't miss out on any future episodes. Today, we're talking about Uber's $5 billion loss, asking if WeWork is we worthless, and giving our 2 cents on Disney's new streaming package. So we'll kick off today talking about probably one of the most talked about companies on the market this year, Uber. So they reported their quarterly earnings about 2 weeks ago, and the big news that everybody was talking about was that big $5 billion loss. So pretty hefty loss. But in fairness, most of it was based on stock-based compensation related to the IPO back in May. But even without that, the company burned close to $1 billion in cash in that three-month period. CEO Dara Khosrowshahi, I'm sorry for absolutely butchering that name.
There's actually there's a YouTube video with a woman just saying his name times.
Yeah.
That I have to listen to every time we go onto this.
We'll fix it in post. Yeah. but he said anyway that he expects this year to be the company's peak investment year, quote unquote, and that losses will temper in 2020 and 2021. But yeah, its stock is down about 20% now from its $45 IPO guidance. And, you know, the company's kind of going through the ringer in its first few quarters as a public company. But losses aside and stock-based compensation aside, we need to go back and talk about that cash burn, because that's Tesla levels of money being spent. The company, by its own admission, says it's in the early stages of capturing what it estimates to be a $12 trillion global market. That's trillion with a T. And that includes all of its subsections like freight and food delivery and stuff like that. But when you look at the company's report, the overall bookings are rising, but its take rate, so this is the percentage of gross bookings retained by the company after drivers' earnings, incentives, promos and refunds and all of that have been taken out, that's actually in steady decline. So it declined 22% in quarter one 2018 and it's down to 17% now in the most recent quarter. And it's kind of, it's for me, I think the biggest worry for me, as I see as Uber as an investment, is that we talk about Disney coming in with Netflix and Apple coming in with Netflix, and we always say it's not exactly a zero-sum game, that there's room for multiple subscription packages. I don't believe that in a thing like ride-sharing there is room for many. I think people are just going to go with the most effective and the most, it's particularly cost-effective. Uber, infamous for all the incentives they've rolled out, and especially in recent times where there's been a lot of kickback, particularly from their drivers, about how the company treats them. There's a lot more drivers' incentives coming in and stuff. And in the most recent filing, the company said, quote, "As we aim to reduce driver incentives and improve our financial performance, we expect driver dissatisfaction will generally increase."
Yeah, so, that'll happen.
Yeah.
That's usually what happens when you pay people less.
So for me, you know, you look at the $5 billion spent in the last quarter, and that's a worry. But the more specific worry, I think, is that they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. They've got a high market share at the moment, but as they try to become more profitable, both drivers and users are going to start moving away to other competitors. And they have such an amount of competitors. You know, if you look in the US, there's obviously Lyft, but Uber are spreading internationally. There's other things like Ola, which is in India. There's Careem, there's Didi in China. There's hundreds of competitors popping up. And that's just talking about ride sharing. When you look at food delivery, there's Grubhub, DoorDash, Deliveroo. From every aspect, I think Uber is spreading out too much, and they're going to struggle to turn a profit.
Yeah, and there's a consolidation as well. Over here on this side of the Atlantic, we have Freenow, which is a joint partnership between BMW and Daimler to basically vacuum up all the taxi services in 100 cities, and they've put a lot of money behind that brand and they've grabbed attention and mind space.
I will say though, in London, Freenow just doesn't, it's just not even on the radar.
Oh, really?
Uber's just totally dominant.
Right.
It's probably important to mention Freenow is not ride sharing as such, too.
No, that's true. That's true, but it is. It's a substitute product.
Yeah.
You know,
I think you mentioned the investment year. that's that they're being pretty charitable to themselves.
Yeah.
When they say it's an investment year, I think that's code for we're going to keep losing an awful lot of money, so get used to it.
And the expression in for a penny, in for a pound springs to mind, which I've just adeptly Googled, and it's defined by Oxford as used to express someone's intention to see an undertaking through, however much time, effort, or money it entails.
Sums it up pretty well.
I know the CEO, there was a kind of comparison going around after the earnings. It's like people can talk about them as like the Amazon of transport, which the CEO, Derek Khashoggi, did use that term. Thanks. He did use that term. And, you know, the idea being, you know, Amazon spent an awful lot of money in their early days. But the difference, of course, is Amazon was actually generating loads of cash and investing in their future, building warehouses and getting their logistics in order. What Uber are investing in is this notion that there'll be driverless cars soon.
Yeah.
We really don't know when it's going to happen. Some people think Elon Musk thinks it's going to be in 2 months' time.
Yeah.
And other people think it's, you know, 10, 15 years away. So
drivers going to be very annoyed about those driverless cars. So moving on then.
Before we go to moving on. So the question is, are you bullish or bearish on Uber over the very long term?
I'm bearish. Hmm. I'm bearish.
I actually think they might pull it off.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, if you have a founder, a CEO who is talking about a 12 trillion opportunity and is giving it a shot, well, it certainly makes you sit up straight.
Yeah, I mean, and like, they're overvalued at the moment.
Yes.
But overvalued can also mean they have a lot of people willing to give them money.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I don't know. Look, it's a really tough one.
And the brand strength is unbelievable.
Yeah, brand strength
like,
is really
Uber
strong.
Is now a verb.
Yeah. Uberification? Was it? Uberization?
Yeah.
The Uberification.
Uberification,
yeah.
So moving on to another company that's had a lot of flack maybe poured out recently. Rory, I'll let you lead in with this.
Yeah, we're going to talk about WeWork. It's the company on everyone's tongue. I had so much fun reading about this company over the last few days. And when I got to it, I was like, you have all these notes and you go, where do you start?
Yeah.
Like, where do you start with? There's so much going on. But anyway, so they posted their S1, which you should really think of an S1 as like a company's dating profile their cover letter for a job application. You know, you really want to push your best self forward. So the first line of S1s are obviously always very interesting as well. We've had some good recent examples. It was Snap, a camera company. So I'm just going to read the first line from WeWork's S1. Okay, here we go. We are a community company committed to maximum global impact. Our mission is to elevate the world's consciousness.
Better than we're a camera company.
Isn't that really like Timothy Leary kind of
acid
trippy?
Yeah.
But it's so perfect because what follows is one of the most bizarre abstract experiences I've ever had in my life. It sets the stage for one of the most bizarre S1s I've ever read. So, you know, what you really want from an S1 is you want to see a company that has a clear vision of what they're doing and how they're going to make money and how they're going to grow in the future. There's a company called Triton Research who do equity research and specifically focus on IPOs. And I'm just going to quote what they said about it. The prospectus, which is their S1, is a masterclass in obfuscation.
Wow. Wow.
And Triton actually has what is called an obfuscation index, which measures how kind of straightforward companies are with these filings. And they have quite a good track record. Like companies that are very straightforward and open about things tend to do very well, and companies that don't tend to perform poorly. So yeah, that quote from Triton, a masterpiece of obfuscation, is quite on the ball.
Yeah.
So some examples of the obfuscation they're talking about. they just give us so little information of, you know, how those locations are performing, or even like, we don't even know when the locations were opened, you know. So instead you get this kind of, they have this really weird infograph, which is just a map of the world and all these dots everywhere, and they're all linked with like a kind of spider web but no legend to tell you what these links mean or when the place opened. They don't say how profitable each workstation is.
Really?
They don't say, give any idea of, like, is there brokerage fees involved? Mm. What's the lifetime value of a member? Like, all this stuff is just kind of left for you to kind of guess.
Yeah.
So that's one element of it. Then there's an awful lot of corporate governance stuff, which is, you know, really mad. The corporate structure, their simplified version of the corporate structure, which they give a graph on, looks like the blueprint for a nuclear submarine. It's just so crazy. There's all these, you know, different companies all operating kind of semi-independently around the world, and some of them are management contracts and some of them are ownership contracts. It's just crazy. But, like, there is a bull case there for this company somewhere. You know, one of the ideas is, like, they claim that it's 57% lower cost per employee than a traditional office space. So the only way they're really getting there is by putting more people in the space. And they claim to have figured this out. You know, someone worked out that they could be operating an employee for every 50 square foot, which is about 5 times better than a traditional office space.
Yeah.
So that could be the technology element to that. And if they can pull that off, that's great. But unfortunately, you just don't know. We don't know what they're doing. The you know, as your man from Triton pointed out, you know, if you build a better mousetrap, explain why it works.
Yeah,
you mentioned them as a technology company there, and they do define themselves as a tech company, which kind of seems odd to me. Would you describe them as a tech company?
It's a very loose definition of a tech company. Yeah, going back to the corporate governance, there's things like, you know, the CEO sold the trademark "we" to them for $6 million.
So he sold it. The CEO sold the trademark to the
founding
company.
CEO.
The founding CEO.
The guy who set it up. I mean, have you ever heard of such a sneaky maneuver?
He's also borrowed like $700 million from the company in the last few years and bought properties and is now releasing them.
Was that to in the S1?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. I rarely have very, very rarely looked forward to shorting a stock because I don't like betting and I don't like...
Just for the listeners, explain exactly what shorting means.
Oh, shorting is something we don't really advocate here. But, and that's why I said so rarely do I do it and so rarely never do we speak about it. But shorting is where you, through your full service brokerage, enter into a contract with somebody and pay them, in this instance, on the promise that they will buy or sell you shares in any company at a fixed price for a predetermined period of time. Yeah. That's a mouthful. In other words, and this concept of shorting has existed since the days of Damascus, where bags of salt, where salt was a commodity and someone could pay someone and say, I will give you, in today's money, $100 now on a promise that you will sell me this bag of salt at today's price at any time up in the next year.
Yeah, yeah.
So you fix the price and therefore the seller of the salt gets 100 up front but accepts the risk that the price of salt might go up and therefore could have made money by just not taking that money. So that principle exists in both directions, up or down, for virtually any commodity. But from the research that Rory did on and coupled with some of the things I read and heard, I just don't like what I've seen. And, you know, we're big believers in, like, the reason the jury's out is on Uber is because they are talking about a great giant global opportunity that you can buy into. And, you know, the data today is a bit ambiguous. For me, the data is beyond opaque. It's actually almost meaningless.
Yeah.
And, you know, the things that I saw when I had a look at the business, when I compared it to a business called IWG, who are better known as Regus, a network of office spaces around the world, a shoulder-to-shoulder comparison is just unbelievable. For example, Regus has circa 3,000 office spaces around the world. WeWork has circa 600. But WeWork's indicative value at the moment is $47 billion, where Regus is $3.5 billion. Regus is profitable. WeWork has circa $2 billion in losses.
Yeah, I saw that comparison as well. I was like, the only thing that's really separating these companies is that WeWork is the plans are so audacious. Like they are the ones who are saying we are going to own the entire world, whereas IWG have no such plans.
They're
keeping it kind of more down to earth.
Exactly. And it could be the technology company thing. It's kind of like a Snap realized, look, we can't say we're an app, so we're a camera company.
Yeah.
Perhaps. Yeah. And I think WeWork said possibly, well, you know, real estate, REIT, whatever, it just doesn't sound right. We're a tech company.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing, like reading through it, you're trying to grab anything that'll give you a sense of how the business is operating, where they're making their money and how it's working, and you just can't. It's so all over the place. It's
What is their critical metric? Are two or three?
Exactly. Yeah, you're really looking out for that.
I think early stage companies, of which My Wall Street is one, is forgiven not having that metric that you slavishly pursue.
Yeah.
But I think when you go to float, it's time to say to the world, here's the thing we do. And here's how it's measured.
You're putting yourself in the microscope.
And totally,
scope,
And like, so people like the three of us and everyone else in the world who is going to forgo a pleasure today, possibly by investing, should know what is the thing that are things that we should be watching and what we work. I'm at a loss.
Yeah, I didn't know. Look, the last private valuation was $47 billion. Obviously, Uber and Lyft both took a big haircut on their past private valuations when they went public. So it's so up in the air as to where this one's going to start off. I really don't know what the market's going to tolerate when it comes to this.
So buy, sell, or hold.
Yeah, I was just about to say.
I've already shown my hand.
I'm getting the feeling we're not so bullish on WeWork.
Well, the thing is, I like the idea of like the company. Like, obviously, there is benefits to the business. Mm. It's not a bad business.
And they're beautiful offices, and people are attracted to aesthetics, and founders and businesses will want to go there because they're in cool locations with pretty setup and free beer or whatever. But at the end of the day, it's the economics of that business over the long term.
Yeah, I mean, look, the one thing they do, and they do really well, is they turn a fixed cost into a variable cost, which is great for tech companies. It's like, if you're a tech company and you're growing, you know, that the idea that you can go from 2 seats to 20 seats in a month without any kind of movement is really, really powerful.
Yeah, that's right.
So, I just wonder what it's worth.
Yeah.
What's the, and, you know, is the, you know, Scott Galloway did that little Twitter video where he talked about what happens in a recession if you have all these 10-year leases and all the people that you're, who are paying you money have 2-month leases. What happens then? You get stuck with all this, with all this inventory that you're not going to be able to shift. So.
Yeah, yeah.
So when are they expecting or due to go public?
It'll be in the next few weeks. I haven't got a final date yet.
I'm sure we'll be talking about it again. So moving on then, Emmett, you were reading a book recently and it's about a magic formula for investing in the market.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you say I read a book recently, I think I read this book 15, 20 years ago when it was first written. It's, the book is called The Little Book That Beats the Market by Joel Greenblatt.
Fairly well-known one, I believe.
A very well-known book. And we dusted it down for this podcast because when it was written first, it had some earth-shattering claims on its effectiveness. How with a magic formula, as the accompanying website says, magicformulainvesting.com, with a magic formula, you can outperform virtually any index or individual fund manager in the world. And reading a quote from the book, the introduction by Joel Greenblatt, I read directly here. After more than 25 years of investing professionally and after 9 years of teaching at an Ivy League business school, I'm convinced of at least two things. Number one, if you want to beat the market, most professionals and academics cannot help you. Number two, that leaves you only one real alternative. You must do it yourself. So I was like, okay, I buy that. And the method that the book espouses is very simple. You buy quality businesses at bargain prices. So again, using common logic, you go, we want to buy quality businesses at bargain prices.
Makes sense.
So what is the definition of a quality business? Well, in the book, it's framed as return on capital. So return on capital has a formula in its own right, and it's the earnings, or also known as the net profit, divided by the capital invested. So a worked example would be, so if My Wall Street spent $1 million building a training center, and that million was our invested capital, and at the end of year one, the net profit or the earnings from our training center was $300,000, the return on capital is 30%. Okay. $300,000 divided by $1 million. So the first thing you look for in a quality business is return on capital. And the second part of the formula that that Greenblatt espouses is bargain prices. And a bargain price in this case is the earnings yield, which is the earnings per share divided by the share price. And I won't give a worked example on what that is. I could, but it's a little tedious to listen to. So the book basically says that if you follow the magic formula, you will absolutely smash the average returns of the stock market. And what's that mean? So again, if I can read directly from the book, chapter 6, page 32 of the first edition. Over the last 17 years, owning a portfolio of approximately 30 stocks that has a high return on capital and a high earnings yield would have returned approximately 30.8% per year.
Yeah.
Okay, so over 17 years, a CAGR, or compounded annual growth rate, of 30.8% per year is absolutely unnaturally high.
Yeah.
I mean, the greatest legendary investors of our time are in the early to mid 20s% per year. So the claims that this book had, and in its subsequent edition, which is called A Little Book That Still Beats the Market, are that by following this formula, you will smash the market return.
Yeah, not just beat it.
No, absolutely annihilate it. Yeah. So as you can imagine, the investing world took great interest in this book because the credentials of the author are next to none. Mm. Like, he is genuinely, he's the real deal. So we're some 17 or so years on from when the book was first written. I stand to be correct. It's probably, I haven't checked, 15, 17 years on. And then just to explain what you do with that formula, there's a couple of steps. You generate a large sample of companies. And in the book, Greenblatt uses 3,500 listed companies. You rank them based on return on capital, as explained. And you then rank them based on earnings yield, as explained. And you add the rank for both, for each firm, and you purchase the 30 best. And you put it in your diary to, in 1 year from now, come back and refresh your portfolio based on a couple of other little criteria.
Yeah.
And the promise that's upheld is that you will absolutely destroy the market. So now we have the benefit of hindsight to see how, in fact, the magic formula has performed. And I just don't believe the results are as good as it seems. And a lot of other blogs and investors and academics have tried to simulate the magic formula performance from the book. But none that I can found have that I can find have even come close.
Yeah.
It is extremely difficult to carry through on the returns that are, I wouldn't say promised in the book, but indicate in the book. And the perfect example, the way of really getting there is on the front page of magicformulainvesting.com, which is the website that accompanies the book, Gotham Index returns are there, taking up half the page. And the Gotham Index was the vehicle that you could invest in to replicate the magic formula's formula.
Okay.
So you could read the book and you had three choices, ignore it, do it yourself, or go with Greenblatt's Gotham Index.
Yeah.
And so right now today, in big bold letters on the website, Gotham Index Plus is in the 10th percentile of Morningstar's large blend category since inception. I'm sorry, that's not good. Like, if you are trouncing the market with 30+% CAGR, you won't be in the top 10th percentile. You'll be in the top 1 percentile.
Yeah.
1 percentile. So it hasn't played out. And I have a whole load of academic papers. Somehow, Scandinavia took great interest, and there's a bunch of white papers from University of Stockholm, School of Economics, and there's one from University of Finland. And in those local stock markets, by applying the rigor of the formula on their own markets, it's marginally beaten the average return. So, yeah, it's a formula that appears to beat the market marginally, but I can't find evidence of a person or of a paper or an academic who have reliably replicated the returns that the book has kind of led with.
Yeah.
So I think, I mean, there is no mistruth. There's nothing in the book that is a lie or a mistruth. The data that was analysed by Greenblatt was absolutely accurate, but it just didn't play forward in a manner that a reader would have expected.
I remember you, I think that was one of the first books you gave me
yeah.
to read on investing, and I remember reading it and thinking, I really hope this doesn't work. because if it works, it sucks all the fun out of it. Like, it literally, like, it turns it into, the, like, it's like when you... it's like when you're playing a video game or something and you figure out the cheat code that automatically wins you every game and suddenly, like, it's, well, why
you just walk
anymore?
Through it. Yeah, this is true. And there's only two stocks in our app that... So when we sit down as a team to find quality businesses for a long-term investor, there's a range of resources we use. Mm. And frankly, the Magic Formula Investing website has never... Sorry, almost never been one. It has been a source we used once, and that's the royal we. That was the me. And I had a look through the bottom line list of stocks, and I pitched to the two of you, Eurocall, a really, really promising business called Nautilus, famous for the Bowmaster. Is it Flexmaster?
Flexmaster,
Bowflexer. Yeah, okay, so that has not transpired as one of our more astute decisions. And frankly,
it's the worst performing stock in our app, is it?
By a long way.
And it was the number one, top of the pile on the Magic Formula Investing.com's filter when you applied Greenblatt's formula. Obviously, one single data point does not make for a data set. Yeah. So I'm not trying to say, and therefore it's all garbage, but the big picture for me now, all these years later, is that the book just didn't really deliver. And there'd be far more Maseratis and Lamborghinis driving around Dublin if, in fact, it had been as accurate as it promised, because I told everyone to read it.
So moving on from I read a book. We're coming to the end of the month now, but there's loads of new stuff in the My Wall Street app at the moment, including our new stock edition for August. Rory, do you want to give a one-sentence description of the new stock edition?
One sentence. They are the leaders in getting the truth out there.
Sounds like a religious cult.
X-Files style.
Yeah.
They are trying to get it out there.
Cool. Mm. So you can check that out in the My Wall Street app now. I just want to remind you as well that our first seminar event in person is coming up soon too. This is your opportunity to meet with the My Wall Street analyst team and absorb more than 25 years of investing experience into one day. For more information on in person, please visit the link that's been included with the show's notes today, or just Google My Wall Street in person. That's INPERSON. Moving on then, jargon busters. Let's bust some jargon. A question in from one of our customers, Keith. Thanks for the question, Keith. He asked, what are our thoughts on the new Disney bundle package? So Disney recently announced that their new Disney Plus service will be available as a bundle along with ESPN Plus and Hulu for $12.99 a month. Rory?
Yeah, it's that was the big announcement from their earnings. So they missed their earnings.
Yeah.
Because they were spending an awful lot of money trying to kind of incorporate Fox's assets into their... into their operations, but the kind of headline story was that there will be a bundle. Bob Iger had already kind of put it out there that it was a possibility, but now we actually have like even a confirmation of it, at least that for $12.99 a month you'll get Disney Plus plus an ad supported version of Hulu,
and
ESPN Plus.
Yeah, it struck me. The very first thing I thought was, that's the same price as Netflix.
Yeah, it's definitely focusing in on the Netflix customer, and like it's we've talked about Disney Plus a lot before, and we broke down the actual product when it first came out, and I think I was blown away by how good it looked anyway from a consumer point of view.
Stunning.
They had their press launch in comparison to Apple Plus's was just apples and oranges, no pun intended there. But yeah, I think this is going to be a really, really good package for people. Like, if you Disney Plus is going to be a big feature in a lot of American households.
Yeah,
because it services a need that is there, which is that kids need entertainment, and if you want to, you have a family friendly, 100% safe, no parental controls needed. Watch whatever you want on this service.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going to have, and they'll be sitting there and they'll be watching it, happy for hours watching Marvel films. And
but you're right there, Rory. As a parent, and my kids have their own Netflix account, they can drift over and watch stuff that I'd prefer they didn't see. And you're absolutely, that is a huge, huge sales point for virtually any parent in the world.
Yeah, so that, I think that's it's going to be a no-brainer, really, for an awful lot of parents. And then, you know, if there's any sports fans in the house, ESPN Plus is there. Now, that's not going to be... I don't think that's big a sales pitch, as part of the sales pitch as people think, because to get the big events, you still need to have cable and ESPN, so it's kind of a diluted version of, of it. But Hulu is like the adult-centric content then, so you really do have a kind of all-in-one package for the whole family, essentially.
Yeah.
And if there's a sports fan there, all the better.
Yeah, yeah.
But I still don't think it's going to be a Netflix killer. I still think Netflix is going to end up being the baseline that nearly that most households have. And this could possibly be number two on the list. And then you might have a couple of, you know, ones that you check in on for particular shows and kind of switch back and forth between a couple of different ones.
So could a company like Roku, which is quite like service agnostic, could they be the big winner out of all this? Just to go off on a tangent.
Yeah, I mean, there's a someone referred to Roku as the one stream to rule them all. so if they can be part of all that, Roku will benefit as well.
Yeah, cool. So the next question we got in was from another customer, and Emmett, I'm going to point this towards you. They asked, is there ever a point when outstanding shares are not available? So for example, if current shareholders don't want to sell and therefore no new buyers can't buy stock.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a question about stock liquidity, effectively. And stock liquidity is the ability to buy or sell a stock without affecting the price. So that means that there are enough shares out there for someone to sell at any point in time or to buy at any point in time. And stock markets have a function called a market maker. And a market maker is effectively a company or a person, an individual, that always quotes a buy and a sell price for a share. So you can look at that share you fancy and get a bid or an ask, as it's commonly referred to by big service, full service brokerages. So they essentially are a liquidity provider, and they make a profit off what's known as the bid offer spread. So for big businesses, it's general rule, large companies, you can always buy or sell the stock that you want to buy in the moment because of the functions provided by your full service brokerage. And in giant markets, you know, the US, in the SEC, in the Securities Exchange Commission in the US, defines a market maker as a firm that stands ready to buy and sell a stock at all times.
So to keep the liquidity.
So with your big brand stocks, there is always a market there, and the system is set up in order to help somebody achieve the price they want. There's a couple of exceptions, and I'm sure those exceptions are where the question is pointed. And let me actually give an example. About 2 years ago, JT, my Wall Street's co-founder, and I went up to NASDAQ's First North Exchange in Stockholm City for the flotation of an Irish company called Zutec. And their market cap at flotation was something, and I stand to be correct, was something like $20 million, which is really, really, really small. It's smaller than a nanotech. It's microtech, you could say. Although then again, hold on, nano is smaller than micro. So anyway, it was small.
We knew your physics degree was coming at last.
Finally.
I've been waiting for this moment. Stop the clock. Drops the mic. So Zutec were floating at something like 20 million. And I think that's as low as you go. And you can go. And it begged the question. And I asked the question, how do you sell your shares? I actually asked one of the founders, you know, how will you take money off the table without crushing the share price? I mean, if that person was inclined to try and liquidate $4 million of their stock, which is not entirely unreasonable if you're in the autumn of your career and you've worked your whole life to this point. In that case, example, that could be the 20% of the entire business. So it was an extreme example of the need for liquidity. And the answer to that question was, as you could probably guess, and in that case, the CEO or his advisors would need to go out and find a buyer and bring the buyer to the exchange, if you like, so the deal is done before even heading into the exchange.
Okay.
So the first point of two is that the smaller the business, the more illiquid its shares become. And that's why we say for small cap companies, you know, you should make sure that you are buying shares in the middle of a normal trading day at least, or have limit orders on your small companies. There's another event, which is a free fall. And if the market has gone into a free fall situation, as it did on two occasions really in the last 20 years, which was the dot-com bust or, in around summertime of 2000, and then a few years later in 06, you basically have, or was it 08?
08.
Sorry, 08, financial crisis.
Yeah.
I'm all over it. And and basically, no, I started to feel it in 06. That was probably it. No, but when the market goes into a free fall situation, market makers struggle to actually create that liquidity. So,
okay.
So effectively, it's the long answer to a short question is that if you're buying a business that has a certain amount of size, let's just say, for argument's sake, $1 billion plus, there will be enough liquidity in normal market conditions to buy or sell.
Buy and sell, yeah.
Very, very close to the price that you're looking at on your screen in the moment.
Yeah.
Other factors come into play if, you know, all hell is broken loose and everything is on sale and everything is falling. But that is an exceptional circumstance that has different dynamics.
Okay, cool. So let's move on to elevator pitch then. So for this week's elevator pitch, I asked you guys to pick a company that's experiencing some success at the moment, but that you feel there's storm clouds gathering on the horizon. So they might be in for a bit of pain over the next few quarters or years. Rory, let's go to you first. We're running out of time, so I'm only going to give you 30 seconds.
Oh, God. Well, Yeah, okay. So the company has been incredibly successful over the last 10 years. I think it's up 32-fold. If you'd held it for the last 10 years, is Domino's Pizza. And their last quarter was just a real disaster. They missed sales growth by a big margin, about 20 million. Their same-store sales was supposed to be, was expected, like 4.8. Dropped down to 3%. I think they are really feeling the pinch from ride-sharing companies like Uber Eats and Grubhub and things like that, because what they had, their big thing was how frictionless it was to get food delivered to your door, and I just don't think they have that economic moat anymore.
Okay, interesting. Domino's were one of the biggest winners of the last 5 years, 10
definitely.
Years.
One of the most successful investments
ever
made.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Cool. So, Emmett, your company that you feel is in for some pain soon.
I'm going for a multi-year pain story. I'm going to go with Sanderson Farms, ticker SAFM. And Sanderson Farms basically sell frozen chicken.
Yeah.
They kill chickens, they freeze them and they sell them. And the end buyer does what they will, which is usually cook them. So Sanderson Farms had a hell of a run. It's just been a huge growth story from the late 90s. And today is at $3.2 billion frozen chicken giant. And the reason that I'd be slightly bearish over the long term is I think that the world is waking up to the supply chain of anything to do with meat, and that there's substitute products on the horizon that are ultimately going to erode the business's model.
Okay, so you're looking at companies like Beyond Meat? And
exactly.
Okay, interesting. I don't know, I think maybe the Domino's one. I think it's an interesting angle, and it's a company that's been on such a rise recently.
Mm.
I like the Sanderson Farms pitch though. As well.
Yeah, and also, I mean, is it true that Domino's shares have outperformed Netflix over kind of a 10? I've certainly read that.
If they haven't, it's close.
Yeah.
So that's about it from this week's Stock Club. Don't forget, there's loads of great new stuff in the My Wall Street app at the moment, including that new Stock Edition. If there's anything you want us to discuss or explain on the next episode of the podcast, please make sure to get in touch on Twitter. That's at My Wall Street HQ. Or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's pod@mywallstreet.com. Please don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club. And if you're enjoying us, please leave a review for us on whatever platform you listen to us on. That's it from us here. We'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy investing.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.